a highway telling me to go where I can. Such a long way, I don't even know where I am. Such a long way, long, oh, long way. Gonna sit right to where I am, and it's easier to stay here. Think I know my way here. I'm gonna lay here all right.
Hey everyone, welcome to the Light in the Attic podcast. My name is Morgan Chosnick, the online orders manager here at Lyta. If you've ever emailed in about an order, you've talked to me. I'm also a DJ on 90.3 KEXP here in Seattle on Saturdays, noon to 3 p.m., so clearly broadcasting is near and dear to my heart. Normally my good friend Jackie hosts the show, but she's asked me to fill in every once in a while. Anyway, enough about me. We've got a very special episode for you today. Our good friend Hunter Lee, the Grammy-nominated producer of our Lee Hazelwood reissue series, has put together an in-depth introduction to one of our favorite characters here at Lyta, Lee Hazelwood. This is a show for those of you who have never dipped a toe into the wonderful world of Hazelwood, and for those who are already hopelessly devoted to the crooning cowboy. So without further ado, here's Hunter.
My name is Hunter Lee, and I'm co-producer and curator of Light in the Attic Records' Lee Hazelwood series. I'm a huge fan of Lee Hazelwood. He's one of my favorite songwriters, a prolific record producer, and a very fascinating character. For this podcast, I was able to talk to some of Lee's friends, collaborators, and session musicians that played on his albums. Though I will tackle the man's entire career, I'm focused around Lee's personal record label, Lee Hazelwood Industries, LHI Records. I feel that it's one of the richest tangents in Lee's vast discography, and also the centerpiece to Light in the Attic's Lee Hazelwood series. The box set, There's a Dream I've Been Saving, features recorded material from 1966 to 71. Lee procured nearly unlimited resources, had full creative control, and built a mini media empire that went unnoticed at the time. That doesn't diminish the genius and grandiose scale of an amazing body of work. How did it happen? Why did it fall apart? Let's find out.
Let me try something and see here. I quit. Let me cut me a beginning of something. I'll show you something we accidentally stumble onto. See if you like. Just start. Give me an intro, or give me, you know, till I stop you. Till I stop you. Give me one till I stop you.
Who is Lee Hazelwood?
This is Lee Hazelwood.
Some say a hell of a good old boy. Some say a son of a bitch. Some say both in the same sentence. He was a man who moved around, a cult hero that never wanted a cult. He left a trail of burnt bridges, blondes, and a massive body of recorded work that is unparalleled. Most people don't know the name Lee Hazelwood, but nearly everyone has heard his music. In the 1950s, as a DJ turned record producer, songwriter, he, along with guitarist Duane Eddy, created a twang heard round the world.
Okay, go ahead and play it, Issa. Go ahead and play it.
Nearly a decade after the million-selling Rebel Rouser, Lee Hazelwood recorded his signature song, an even bigger hit we all know and love.
Oh, what's the name of it? I forgot. All right, play me some.
Those are the songs everyone knows. They are but grains of sand on the Hazelwood beach. There are hundreds more songs Lee recorded from the mid-1950s to the late 1970s. Beyond being a prolific songwriter and record producer, Lee stumbled into being an accidental pop singer. Lee would often sing his own songwriting demos, cutting a record to give to singers, publishers, and labels in an attempt to cut a deal. A self-confessed non-singer, Hazelwood never intended to release his demos, but his subterranean baritone, weirdo swagger, and cornball humor grew on a certain kind of listener. Here's an early demo from 1956.
Yeah. Fort Worth is a city Fort Worth is a town, 20 minutes to Dallas, if there's no police around. In Fort Worth, yeah, yeah, yeah. Fort Worth, yeah, yeah, yeah. Fort Worth, yeah. Standing on the corner, asked a man for a dime. He said, move on, buddy, this here corner's mine. In Fort Worth, yeah, yeah, yeah. Fort Worth, yeah, yeah, yeah. Fort Worth, yeah. Hear two men are talking, swear that it's a fact. One say you bought lunch, my friend, I'll buy the Cadillacs. In Fort Worth, yeah, yeah, yeah. Fort Worth, yeah, yeah, yeah. Fort Worth, yeah. All the women are pretty as can be. I always go with an ugly one, and I won't care if she leave me. In Fort Worth, yeah. Yeah, yeah, Fort Worth, yeah, 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 Fort Worth, yeah. One man's daughter had a birthday, cute little thing named Alice. Say she had most everything, so he bought her Dallas. In Fort Worth, yeah, 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 Fort Worth, yeah, 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 Fort Worth, yeah, yeah.
In the 50s, Lee released a couple singles under the pseudonym Mark Robinson. He sang a vocal track on the Girl on Death Row soundtrack, but it wasn't until 1963 that he cut his first solo LP. Trouble is a Lonesome Town was never intended to be a Lee Hazlewood record. To Lee, it was simply a demo.
Trouble, which was the first one, Trouble is a Lonesome Town, I did a demo with me because it would save me a lot of time. I would have had to teach somebody how I wanted it narrated, how I wanted it sung, even though non-singers, I am. And so I just made a demo of it. And I wanted somebody that was really good singer to really do this, because I thought it was outstanding. And of course, nobody thought it was outstanding, because it was a concept album, one of the first ones I'd ever heard of. I didn't have that word then in my vocabulary connected with records. It was concept album. But I took it to a friend of mine, and it just laying around. In fact, I was doing some other business with him, you know. He said, well, what's that? And I said, oh, that's just something that I'd really like to take a listen to, because Jack Tracy, who was the head of West Coast for Mercury Records, we were buddies. And he introduced me to a lot of the jazz groups and everything that I really liked. And so I said, that's a demo on an idea I have. And I said, you know, it's kind of folksy, and you're really interested in, people were interested in folk music then. I said, see if you got an artist for it. So he took it home, and that was about 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon. He took it home, and I'm just about ready to crawl in bed that night, along about 11 or 12 o'clock, and the phone rings, and it's Jack Tracy. And he said, I heard that thing, and all I did was laugh and have a good time with it, and it's funny, and I grew up in a little town like that, and da, da, da. I know a lot of people who did what he said, one or the other. And I said, well, great, you like it. He said, I love it. And I said, who you got for it? And he says, I don't have anybody for it. I want to put it out like it is. So that's where that came from. So I became a demo singer, my own demos.
There are people living in trouble that'll tell you that trouble wasn't nothing. No, sir, nothing. Nothing but a little town, that is, until we got our railroad. And, of course, there's people living in trouble today that'll tell you, since we got our railroad, we're still nothing, with a railroad running through it. In fact, about the easiest way to start an argument is to say something either for or against the railroad. Now, I don't have nothing against the railroad or the men that work for it. As far as I've been able to find out, they're hard-working, hard-drinking, hard-dying men, and they're pretty hard-fighting, too. I guess about the only thing that they can't whip is each other. Working
working on the railroad all day long. Working on the railroad, sing this song. Sing about an old love I once knew. Sing about an old love, maybe two. Working on the railroad. Working on the railroad. Work, work, working on the railroad. I drove a lot of hot steel in my time. I drank a lot of stuff they call moonshine. I got me a woman in every town. Working on the railroad, never settled down. Working on the railroad. Working on the railroad. Work, work, working on the railroad. I draw my pay on a Saturday night. Go in town and I start a fight. I love me a woman, I laugh at a joke. I working on the railroad, always a broke. I working on the railroad. I working on the railroad. Work, work, working on the railroad. When I die and you bury me alongside the tracks where I wanna be, don't you cry, friend, just remember this. There ain't much your old buddy missed. Working on the railroad. Working on the railroad. Work, work, working on the railroad.
For the 50-year anniversary of Lee's debut album, Light in the Attic Records released a double LP featuring a mono mix of the record, an insane promo-only EP of Lee narrating his autobiography, and nearly all of his recorded vocal work from 1956 to 63, including demos such as Fort Worth that you just heard, and a couple of singles released under the pseudonym Mark Robinson. Trouble is a Lonesome Town featured a couple session musicians that would play a huge part in Hazelwood's musical career. Guitarist Billy Strange and drummer Hal Blaine were part of a loose musical collective of Los Angeles session musicians now known as the Wrecking Crew. The group would go on to play a pivotal role in the Hazelwood sound. I asked Hal Blaine how it all began.
Billy was a dear friend and a great guitarist and a heck of a band leader. And of course, I was more or less his drummer for many, many, many years. And that's probably where it all started. Lee would sing us a song, and we just fell right into it. That's what we were famous for, not having to take that much time. Lee knew what he wanted, and we gave it to him. Lee was a terrific guy. He might have been a little bit of an oddball to people who didn't know him, but I mean, being on the road with him and doing shows with him and so forth, he was just great. Super guy.
Yeah. We're rolling. We got a question.
I see your burned out cities. I hear your people cry. I see your children hungry. And I watch some of them die. Have you made any new bombs today? I see no birds a-flying, see no trees at all. I only see the dying flowers as they fall. Have you made any new bombs today? I see your rivers dried up, your lonely lovers' lanes. I see your black earth drink up drops of poison rain. Have you made any new bombs today? I see your deadly white clouds, the hot winds that they blow. You won the war, I'm sorry, there's no one left to know. If you've made any new bombs today.
Lee Lee's second solo record, The NSVIPs, saw Lee continue on as the hillbilly Shakespeare, a hayseed philosopher spinning Dust Bowl parables. By this time, he'd signed to Reprise Records, both as an artist and a record producer. Though having chart success with the preteens Dino, Desi, and Billy, Lee's solo records went unnoticed and underappreciated. Though he did gain one important fan, a young singer named Susie Jane Hokum.
Lee was such a good writer of tales. The NSVIPs, Trouble is a Lonesome Town, all those things were what got me in the first place, because those were the first things he ever handed me of his. I would hand him the singles that I'd put out. He handed me those two albums. And that got me. That got me, because they were great. And he really should have been just a writer. That was the part of him that was really outstanding.
Lee's third record, Friday's Child, vanished without a trace. Disillusioned by the arrival of the Beatles and groups performing their own material, Hazelwood decided to retire at the age of 34.
Friday's child, hard luck is his brother.
Friday's child.
Friday's child, his sister's misery. Oh, Friday's child, his daddy, they call hard times. Friday's child, that's me. Friday's child, born a little ugly.
Friday's child.
Friday's child, good looks passed him by. Oh, Friday's child makes something look like nothing. Friday's child am I.
Yeah, I just decided when the world discovered the Beatles, well, I discovered the Stones, and so consequently, at least I had something to talk to them about. And I didn't think there was any comparison. I loved the Stones, and when I met the Stones, I still liked them even better. But I didn't care much for the Beatles. Now, there are a couple of Beatles songs I like, but I just didn't care too much for the Beatles. They sound like four Everly Brothers to me, you know, trying to be Everly Brothers. And that was about all it was. So I thought, why should I make records and compete against all this English group that's coming in? Because everything in the charts was English, or it was Motown. There wasn't any of us managed to slip anything in there. So I thought, I might as well retire. I'm very comfortable anyway. And I did. I just retired. Just as sure as you're sitting there, I retired. I was just very happy to, just sit in my backyard and watch the bugs swim in the pool. That's really what it was. That wasn't so much of a story that I told you, or that I wrote down. And I got offered jobs. Jack Tracy gave me jobs. The Capitol called, Columbia, a couple of people at Columbia, and then some artists who said, have you quit? And I go, yes, I have quit. Quit, stop. That's it, no more. I was in my 30s, I guess. I was in my 30s.
Lee's premature retirement was not to be. He was cajoled from his lethargic slumber by neighbor Jimmy Bowen. Bowen was Frank Sinatra's producer and convinced the reluctant Hazelwood to produce Frank's daughter Nancy. Hazelwood had written a song called These Boots Are Made for Walking, though he never intended for the song to be sung by a woman. Session pianist Don Randy explains how the track came about.
They had an argument over it. You know that story, I'm sure. He didn't want her to sing it. He said, it's a guy song. And she said, oh, no, you're making a big mistake. He said, it's perfect for a little girl like me. And she actually had to talk him into it. That arrangement is the whole thing part. From the bass on, that's an arrangement tune. And, of course, a great lyric. What can I tell you? I can go into any place with a strange band, without any music, and at this horn players, they all know the line on Boots. Bop, bop, ba-da, ba-da, bop, ba-da, ba-da, that end line. And they know, bop, boo-da, ba-da, bop, boo-da. I don't even have to, I can sing it to them and they get it in a minute.
Hey, Boots, that was a great song. It was, for us, it was instant, gigantic hit. And Billy Strange's arrangement was perfect. Introduction, that bass introduction that Chuck Berthauer did that came from Billy Strange, that's the big part of the opening of that song. I mean, as soon as you hear that opening, well, you know what it is.
Me. Something you call love, but confess. You've been a messin' where you shouldn't have been a messin'. And now someone else is getting all your best. These boots are made for walking, and that's just what they'll do. One of these days, these boots are gonna walk all over you.
This is the part of the song where Billy Strange raised his hand and asked if he could leave the room.
You keep lying when you ought to be truthful. And you keep losing when you ought to not bet. And you keep saying when you ought to be changing. Now what's right is right, but you ain't been right yet. Listen to me, these boots are made for walking, and that's just what they'll do. One of these days these boots are gonna walk all over you.
You keep playing where you shouldn't be playing. And you keep thinking that you'll never get burned. Ha! I just found me a brand new box of matches, yeah. And what he knows you ain't had time to learn. These boots are made for walking, and that's just what they'll do. One of these days these boots are gonna walk all over you. Are you ready, Boots? Start walking.
I figure it's a cowboy song, do what I want.
Fresh out of retirement, Lee Hazlewood hit the top of the charts in February 1966 with Boots. Suddenly, he was one of the hottest record producers in Los Angeles. Lee would take full advantage of this, signing multiple deals with many labels, both as an independent producer and as a solo artist. Though he would continue to view his albums simply as demos, and labels like MGM as financiers for his recorded whims, his work hit an all-time creative high, producing some of his finest compositions and greatest productions to date. With Billy Strange as his arranger, the Wrecking Crew as his band, and a bottomless budget that he wasn't paying for, Lee created some beautiful demos.
Lee really needed an arranger. Billy Strange was over the top. He was a great guy. He would do whatever Lee wanted him to do. But he did it with the full command of a big band, and he knew how to do it. And Lee relied heavily. It's like relying on your engineer. It's like relying on your musician. Lee was very smart to pick the very best people. Billy Strange said to him, yeah, I'm going to do the arrangements on this. Let's have 20 violins. It was no skin off Lee's nose.
What?
Let's have 20 violins. Let's have sessions that last forever. God, we've just got all this money. We can spend all this money.
His arms reach out to me, 'cause they know I'm so lonely. Then my mind goes back to you, your sweet love sees me through, your sweet love sees me through.
And I think Lee lived his life with the expectation of the loss, the self-fulfilling prophecy that he was doomed, that it wouldn't last forever, that for one moment.
The hurt I hurt is nothing like the hurts I've hurt before. The things I feel do not feel like things I've felt before. And the loneliness and the emptiness and the hopelessness are fine, because sometimes my cloudy brain remembers for one moment you were mine.
Here I am in a big studio, double studio, with this huge string section, this huge horn section, and this guy loves me, and he's singing this song that he wrote for me. You know, my God, that's romantic.
Young woman, share your fire with me. My heart is cold, my soul is free. I am a stranger in your land, a wandering man, call me Sam.
Oh, sir, my fire is very small. It will not warm thy heart at all. But thee may take me by the hand, hold me, and I'll call thee Sam.
Lee Hazelwood's second record on MGM, 1967's Lee Hazelwoodism, It's Cause and Cure. It's a very interesting record in Lee's discography. A strangely happy record, playful and light. The sound of a man in love.
I still look at those things as very good records and really good songs and a part of me, because that was when we were involved. So to me, I don't think of them as expensive demos. I think of them as product that you want people to love and that you're putting out part of yourself. You know, I think I just fell more and more in love with him because he, you know, he would write me these things. He would sing me these things. We would write these things together. We would hang out. That was the beautiful part of our relationship. And we'd go in the studio. Then I'd be singing background on these sessions with these giant string sessions, you know, sections and these huge orchestras. I mean, it was really fun. When you look back at the MGM stuff, that was really fun for me.
Lee's brief stint with MGM Records yielded three albums: The Very Special World of Lee Hazelwood, Lee Hazelwood-ism, its cause and cure, and something special. Light in the Attic Records released all three records with bonus tracks. I was really excited to see these albums come out because they are some of my favorite recorded Hazelwood works, and also we were able to include nearly all of Lee's recorded output for MGM Records, including non-LP singles, demos, unreleased tracks, and some groovy instrumentals released under the name The Woodchucks. The only things we didn't include were a single by the singer Diane Landry and the solo recordings of Susie Jane Hokum, which will be released in the future on a Susie Jane Hokum compilation. For someone new to Lee Hazelwood, the MGM Records are a great place to start. These albums are filled with great tunes and are beautifully arranged and produced.
I am a part of every road you've walked down, and I am a part of every dream that you found. And when you cry, I cry along with you. And should you die, I know that I'll die too. I am that part of everything that you do. Since I became a part of you, since I became a part of you.
MGM thought enough of Lee that when he brought me into the picture, they signed me.
Lee and Susie's collaboration was now in full force. The pair were writing songs together, singing duets, and Susie Jane would be a prominent backing vocalist on most of Hazelwood's productions. Here's the A-side of Susie Jane Hokum's one and only amazing MGM single.
Just bought me a rabbit's foot and a bunch of good luck charms. I'm gonna use everything I got to get you in my arms. Cause I'm gonna need all the help I can get. I'm gonna need all the help I can get. I'm gonna need all the help I can get. If I'm gonna get you, if I'm gonna get you.
Yearning to be more than just a singer or performing artist, Lee's muse, Susie Jane Hokum, expressed her deep desire to produce records. This fascinated Lee. combination of Lee's huge success with These Boots Are Made for Walking and his partner's desire to produce records led to the formation of their own label. LHI, Lee Hazelwood Industries, was founded in 1966, a cutting-edge endeavor where the record production, songwriting, graphic design, marketing, and nearly every other aspect was handled in-house. Lee and Susie would find acts they believed in, or would use the label as a vehicle to release their own material. Lee gave Susie Jane the first artist to produce, a Texas folk rock band by the name of The Kitchen Sink. Susie Jane had less than a week to deliver a full record. Here's a track from the first LHI LP by The Kitchen Sink, a song first sung by Susie Jane Hokum, now produced by her. The Hazelwood Pen track, Need All the Help I Can Get. The climate of LHI Records was like that of the Wild West. Lee was able to parlay his earlier successes into a mini media empire. From 1966 to 1971, Lee was given piles of money from Decca, ABC, Columbia, Bell, and Ampex to deliver a massive amount of recorded product for those labels to distribute. The corporate climate was lax. Throw it against the wall and see what sticks could have been the moniker. Many artists were given a record deal by simply ringing the doorbell at the lavish 9000 Sunset Strip building. That's not to say the recorded material was low quality, much to the contrary. It was an amazing label with a diversity of styles unmatched. Let's listen to some of the early releases. The first LHI single, released fall of 1966, was by the Texas-born, LA-bred band, The Kitchen Sink. For the Hazelwood series, record producer Alec Palau put together an amazing double LP compilation called When the Rainbow Disappears. I highly recommend checking it out. Another early LHI single was released by Raul Danks and John Taylor, a Scottish folk rock duo not unlike Peter and Gordon or Chad and Jeremy. Susie Jane ran into Raul at the airport, just flown in from Scotland and needing a ride. Susie Jane was happy to oblige. One thing led to another, and the pair cut a handful of great tracks on Lee Hazelwood's dime. Rose Colored Corner by Lynn Castle is a personal favorite among myself and co-producer of the Lee Hazelwood series, Light in the Attic owner Matt Sullivan. We were blown away by the originality of her music. Lynn was the lady barber, cutting hair of all the hippest musicians in LA, including the Monkees, Buffalo Springfield, and of course Lee Hazelwood. She cut her one and only amazing LHI single, A Winter Night, Midnight, Phoenix, Arizona at Audio Recorders, the studio made famous by Lee's earlier recordings with Duane Eddy. Discuss what really isn't there, but I'm happy in my rose-colored corner. No hurry to go anywhere. The people, they keep all their secrets. To their four-walled gray world. band backing Lynn Castle on that track is Last Friday's Fire, another LHA artist who recorded a couple psychedelic pop singles with Lee, including this Hazelwood Pin track, I Can't Help the Way I Feel.
See her sad eyes filled with anger, giving kisses to a stranger. She knows she can have my love no more. I can't help the way I feel, the way I'm
Singer Michael Graham knocked on the door of the LHI building, was let in, sang Lee a demo, and given a record deal. They cut this track, Pastel Dreams.
And you were divided, your heart would patter just to pass the time. Your tears could fill a cold room, and you
with all this music being recorded, where was Hazelwood on all this? Though Lee was still contractually obligated to other labels such as MGM and Reprise to churn out solo records, he used LHI and his artists as a vehicle to record his own songs, such as this track Little War. Lee's version could be found on his MGM record Something Special, while Susie Jane's version was released on LHI. To get a feel for what LHI Records was like on a day-to-day basis, I spoke with LHI General Manager Tom Thacker, who was there at the beginning.
Well, the daily basis was Lee didn't come in until Lee wanted to come in, and he had night curtains on his office that completely, or day curtains, I guess, that completely blocked out any light. And I came to work. I was used to a pretty rigid schedule, having been in radio, and I came to work every morning at promptly at 9 a.m. and drove in from Orange County. And one day Lee came trotting in. He said, what time did you get in this morning? I said, 9. He said, have you ever missed a day of work? And I said, no. And he said, well, then take the rest of the day off. For God's sake, you can't feel like coming to work every day. It was a bunch of young people trying to make hit records. There wasn't the kind of organization and flip-flap and corporate crap that goes on now. It was creating and doing things, and most of the people were creative. Most of them were talented. I thought that Honey Limited was a hit act. I mean, I just absolutely believe now.
I absolutely believe in the Honey Limited as well. They're one of my favorite LHI groups. Four girls from Detroit with a beautiful harmony blend cut an amazing record with Lee. The 8-song album fetches around $2,000. That's about $100 a minute. I'm going to go ahead and give you 2.5 minutes right now on me. Enjoy the Honey Limited and listen to that killer Carol Kay bass line.
Satisfied.
If you're interested in hearing more of the Honey Limited and don't have $2,000 for an original pressing, you should check out the Light in the Attic released complete LHI recordings of the Honey Limited. It includes their rare 8-song record, the 3 songs they did with television theme song guru Mike Post, and a couple unreleased instrumentals they didn't quite finish. So with all these songs being recorded, artists being signed, and money being spent, was the label successful? The short answer is no. The long answer is a little more complicated. The label could have been very successful, but some bad calls, unlucky breaks, and big egos prevented that from happening. One such tale is the could have been, would have been, should have been hit of Angel of the Morning, sung by Danny Michaels. Lee and LHI had recorded and released a version of the soon-to-be hit by Merrily Rush and the Turnabouts. But the LHI version was either in the wrong place, the wrong time, or just didn't have the magic it needed to top the charts. I asked Danny Michaels about Lee and Angel of the Morning.
I actually was singing in a nightclub there on the Sunset Strip, and a voice came out of the darkness saying I needed a haircut. Well, the gal that said that was signed with Lee at the time. Her name was Lynn Castle.
Oh, wow.
And she was one of the top hairdressers in L.A. at the time. She did Elvis and his boys. The Stones would come through, and she'd do their hair. And she was also recording with Lee Hazelwood and writing with him. She liked my singing, and we became friends after she cut my hair. And then introduced me to Lee, took me up to his office, and Billy Strange was there. Lee had Billy Strange there, and Billy Strange liked it and liked my singing. And that's how it started. He signed me to the label, and we started recording.
Deep, booming voice, you know, for a little guy, he sounded like he was 8 feet tall.
Very hip guy, you know, you could talk to him about anything, and as long as it's pertinent to, you know, what you were about. And he was very, very, very good conversationalist, interested. He was interested in a lot of things. He had a lot of ambition, and he wasn't afraid to pursue his interests. Did on it. You know, when I recorded Angel of the Morning, he'd just been in the studio with Nancy, and we had the whole studio. I mean, what an expensive production. I think we had 8 violin pieces and the Blossoms on backup. And we kind of rushed through Angel, and I would have, the day after, I wanted to redo it, and Lee said, no, I wanted to do my vocal, because I didn't feel I'd, even Jack Nitzsche mentioned something about we should redo that one, but we never did. A guy named Chip Taylor wrote it, and Lee found the song, called me in, and again, Billy Strange was there, and played it for me, and then I went home and practiced it and came back, and then we decided to record it. You know, even Mary Lee Rush and Juice Newton, who really had the gigantic hit with it after Mary Lee Rush, they all used Billy's arrangements. All three of us used Billy Strange's almost verbatim arrangement. It was interesting how Billy Strange affected all three artists in their releases.
Just call me Angel of the Morning.
Beyond finding hit songs, another key to running a successful record label was finding hip artists. I would be hard-pressed to find someone hipper than Gram Parsons in the late 60s, a prolific singer and songwriter who would later go on to play with the Rolling Stones and the Byrds. He was found by Lee and Susie first. Susie Jane produced a record by Gram's band, the International Submarine Band, the end of 1967. The LP, Safe at Home, was an amazing genre-bending record. Considered by some the first country rock record, Hazelwood dubbed it Hippie Billy. New Year's Eve, 1967. While Susie Jane Hokum sat in one studio at United Recorders in Los Angeles with the International Submarine Band and Graham Parsons, Lee was in another with Don Randy and an LHI artist simply known as Arthur. The three men created a haunting, ethereal record, Arthur Lee Harper's Dreams and Images. A truly psychedelic folk record, the album feels like one long song. A soft-spoken poet, Arthur's delicate songs were beautifully arranged by Don Randy's sparse yet otherworldly arrangements. Hazelwood must have known none of these songs would have topped the charts, but a contractual obligation and fulfilling a product quota never sounded so pretty.
Okay, count them off.
The streets are lined with silver and gold. He's under a spell. Then he finds he's losing his hold. He's a mortal. Girl takes a flight on an azure dream, catches a vision of a twilight scene. She tries to return, but she's caught in between.
The Light in the Attic reissue of Arthur's 1968 LP is taken from the pristine master tapes and features three additional tracks recorded during the LHI sessions. While Lee's production of Arthur's record was heard by few, Susie Jane's International Submarine Band album was heard by a few important listeners. Via Derek Taylor, the Beatles had heard Susie Jane's production and were interested in working with her. The Beatles were about to launch their own independent label, Apple Records. They were interested in getting Susie Jane Hokum on board. That was something Lee Hazelwood was not interested in. He refused to explore the idea of working with the Beatles. This led Susie Jane Hokum to tear up her LHI contract in front of Lee, though she was still bound by it, and to meet John Lennon and Paul McCartney in New York City in May of 1968, when the pair were in New York announcing the formation of Apple Records. I've seen photos of the meeting. Susie Jane explained the only place the Beatles could get peace and quiet was on a Chinese junk boat in New York Harbor. So there was John and Paul, looking like they'd just walked out of the photos included in the White Album. Then Paul disappeared, and there were photos of John and Susie drinking champagne directly from the bottle. Where was Paul? Susie Jane explained that he'd grabbed her camera and started snapping photos of her and John. The photos are joyous for what could have been, and incredibly sad for what never was. Despite the fact that LHI Records would have gotten an imprint on anything Susie Jane worked on, and Lee Hazelwood an executive producer credit, even on a Beatles record, Lee refused to move forward with the deal. I'd like to think, in a parallel universe, Susie Jane Hokum produced the Beatles. Instead of staying in gloomy England and cutting Let It Be, they migrated to Los Angeles, worked together and apart, like they had on the White Album, brought in Wrecking Crew players, as George Harrison had on his production of Jackie Lomax's record. Imagine the record Get Back could have been recorded in LA with Susie Jane Hokum. It could have been revitalizing, changed everything. A pipe dream, perhaps, but an experiment never made nonetheless. The first fissures in LHI's foundation were formed.
Thank you.
I'm just a poor man with a heart full of love. I'm just a poor man with a heart full of love. I'm just a poor man with a heart full of love, just for you, just for you.
Hazelwood was unfazed. He decided to go to France for 8 weeks to cut a record, Love and Other Crimes. Oh, and he also decided to bring his band from LA. Hal Blaine, Don Randy, Donnie Owens, Chuck Berghoffer, and James Burton all made the trip to France to cut the record.
This is for baby.
With me, when I got off the air, when we did that album in France, I get off the airplane. We had just been flying 13 hours. We're all, you know, I don't know what I'm walking into. And all the guys go to the rooms. And as I'm getting ready to go to my room, there's Lee standing there, you know. He said, "Who are you going?" I said, "I'm going to get some sleep." He said, No, we don't have charts. You got to write the charts. Said, "What are you talking about?" There I had to go. I mean, there's a picture. You see with my head down on the piano, my eyes closed? That's because I was sleeping. People say, "Why were you like that? Were you snoring or what?" No, I was fucking sleeping. I never did catch up, you know. And of course, here we are in Paris, you know, and I am a bit of a food gourmet. I love food. And I like restaurants, the big restaurants. And here we are in Paris. He found the most American restaurant that served a hot beef sandwich and mashed potatoes in France. And that's where we went. Lee took us out. And I'm looking at him, I said, "Are you kidding me?" But that was Mr. Hazelwood.
Crying losers' tears and knowing that I never should have run the race.
And you know, you probably know this, but in France, he was as big or bigger than Jerry Lewis. Well, I tell you, Lee was such a major star in France. He had so many wonderful fans over there. There were French fans, but a lot of European fans, but you know, and I know that Lee was given that Medal of Honor or whatever it is from the president of France or whoever gave that honor out, that medal. And we were all very proud of that. And it was one of those things where we had such mutual respect, not only for Lee Hazelwood as an artist, but for us as musicians.
Spring things, talk about spring things. It's the spring things, it's the spring things, mother spring things, mother spring things, mother spring things. Let's just hear one from me. See where I know where I'm blowing it. Let me just hear one. Can we? No, it's not faggy to do that line first, baby. It's right.
One, two.
Because it's put down.
One, two, three.
What makes that guy look good when you know that he don't?
What makes you date that girl when you're sure that she won't?
It's the spring thing.
It's that spring thing.
While recording solo albums, launching LHI, and producing many other artists, Lee had also continued his successful run with Nancy Sinatra. Their partnership culminated in 1968's Nancy and Lee LP, including this song, Some Velvet Morning, which may be Hazelwood's finest recorded moment.
Some velvet morning when I'm straight, I'm gonna open up your gate and maybe tell you about Phaedra and how she gave me life and how she made it in. Some velvet morning when I'm straight.
Flowers grow.
At the height of their collective power, Nancy and Lee decided to call it quits. In 1968, they dissolved their partnership. The pair had a magic chemistry together, though Lee may have not realized it at the time. Billboard magazine announced Lee was hoping to duplicate the success he had had with Nancy with a new female foil, Ann Margaret. Lee cut two amazing psychedelic singles with Ann Margaret for LHI Records. The A-sides, You Turn My Head Around and Sleep in the Grass, are two of Lee's finest late 60s compositions.
I told myself I'd never feel again. I said I'd never care what's real, but then
the material was strong. It would have been interesting to see what would have happened had Nancy recorded the Hazelwood songs. But a familiar LHI story, the singles went nowhere. But Lee kept moving. His trip to France to record Love and Other Crimes was just the beginning of a series of adventurous recording sessions in exotic locations. His next record was also with Ann Margaret. The pair flew to Nashville for a weekend to cut a country record, The Cowboy and the Lady.
Let's take a listen now and see what we don't like. I want you to know something. It may not be worth a damn, but it just swings its ass off out here. Too many bad notes, Donnie?
No, let's do it.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Ready?
Aha! Uh-huh, she found the word. Don't tell her till after the day. Let's do it.
Before we start, can I just hear about the intro and about two or three bars into it, just for us right now, and then we'll do it, please?
The donor slowly.
All right. Can we do another one, Charlie? And take one. Mistakes and all. And there'll be some.
Here we go.
searching fingers of the dawn are slowly give me another start because I blew the notes. How many other lovers have awakened to find their own gray dawn?
I blew the goddamn lyric. You can't see.
It's okay, I'm glad you did. We were close, we were real closely. We'll get it this time.
But you can't see it, you know, it's bent. And I'm getting bent over this song.
Come on, come on. Here we go, if you're ready. You want to take a little break, you want to go?
Hell, let's do it.
Okay.
I got enough problems, Charlie.
Lee's partnership with Ann Margaret was a whirlwind. It lasted less than a year, yet yielded many great tracks. The pair planned to do a second record, but nothing ever came of it. Lee kept moving, this time to England, to cut a record with famed producer Shel Talmy. Like The Cowboy and Lady before it, it was a strange Hazelwood record in that he didn't write any of the songs. On the eve of Lee's 40th birthday, he cut the LP 40 with Shel Talmy in England. Shel and Lee shared a lawyer in a man named Marty Mouchat, who is coincidentally the lawyer for Bob Dylan and Leonard Cohen. Lee approached Shel and asked if he would produce a record for him. This was a record for Lee Hazelwood, the artist and the singer, a record in which Shel would produce, pick the songs, gather the session musicians and the arrangers. This uncharacteristic combination made for a very interesting Hazelwood record. For a good portion of the record, Shel Talmy utilized amazing British arranger David Whittaker. You've heard David's work on many, many famous British records. The sample that the Verve used on Bittersweet Symphony is the sound of David Whittaker's strings.
She knew I'd take her side in everything she did, even if it might be wrong. That's why she stayed so long.
While Lee was gallivanting around the world, cutting records, LHI Records was still very much active in Los Angeles. A couple years had passed, and the sound of popular music was changing, and LHI was changing with it. The latter half of LHI features a distinctly soul-influenced sound. The reason for this is one man named Larry Marks.
I knocked on Lee's door, on LHI's door. I didn't know who he was. I didn't know LHI Records, but I knew it was a record company. I could see that on the door, so I went in and, you know, I made an appointment and met him and played the record for him, played the artist for him. He liked it. And that's how it started. In those days, you know, the major companies, RCA, Columbia, Warner, I mean, you had impressions of those companies. There were a lot of small labels in those days. LHI was one of them. So I didn't really even know who they were. I didn't even know if this was the right kind of product for them. I had no idea. I just know I wanted to make a deal. In those days, things were, you know, people were, you know, were it was kind of the Wild West in the music business in those days. But when I met Lee, you couldn't help but like the guy. I mean, he was very likable, very knowledgeable, very clever, very funny. And just a good guy. He was very authentic. I mean, what you saw, you got. I mean, that's the way he was. He was not one way to one person and another way to somebody else. He was who he was. He was a very genuine person in that sense. He said, what do you want to do with his artist? I said, well, I'd like to produce. I don't remember this conversation very well. He said, what do you want to do with him? I said, well, I'd like to produce a single. He said, have you ever done that before? I said, well, no, I haven't. He said, well, would you mind if we produced that single? I said, not at all. So we went in the studio and we started doing this record with him. And then somewhere in that process was doing those sessions that Leo offered me a job. He said, do you want to come work for me and go on staff as a producer and as a writer and as an arranger, as an artist? And I said, sure, absolutely. And that's how it started.
Mama never had the luxury she wanted. Cause my daddy didn't try.
Larry's R&B influence brought a distinctly different flavor to LHI Records. The artist you just heard, John Christian, was the artist that Larry pitched to Lee on that initial meeting. But he also produced former Motown singer Barbara Randolph. While recording Barbara Randolph, an interesting formula was discovered. A Lee Hazlewood composition, produced and arranged in a soul vibe. A genre Hazlewood hadn't really dabbled in.
One of the things that I did was, again, take Lee's material, and when I was doing it either with myself or with somebody else, I tried to, you know, try to add a different dimension to it. You know, get it out of the, you know, get it out of the mode that it was in and try to put it into another genre, if you will. Okay, I did this album with him, and I did this album for him, I should say. It was all his material, and it was all R&B-ish kind of soul arrangements to the material. And the album never came out, but when he moved to Sweden, he took all the tapes with him and so forth and so on, took my voice off the album, put his voice on the album. Now, don't forget, these were in my keys, it was my charts, it was my everything. We had, Lee Hazlewood was not even remotely going to be considered as an artist for this album, and that's what he wanted. But then he put his voice on it, and as it turns out, posthumously, people were saying it was one of the best albums that he ever did for himself as an artist.
Take 13.
Please to lay me down and find a face.
All right, I don't know what happened there. Is that thing in tune?
By 1970, LHI Records had been operating about 4 years. Hemorrhaging cash and burning bridges with distributors, Lee finally decided to pack it up and split LA for good. While traveling the world, cutting records and cutting deals for LHI, Lee had found a fondness for Sweden. He had hits there, and he had struck up a friendship with Swedish film director Torbjörn Axelman. One of the pair's earliest collaborations is the film Cowboy in Sweden. It is essential viewing for any Hazlewood fan. Light in the Attic Records restored the film and included it in the box set There's a Dream I've Been Saving. The album Cowboy in Sweden is a favorite among Hazlewood fans. It features tracks recorded during 1969 and 70 in Los Angeles, in Stockholm, and in England. It captures Lee between two worlds, where he'd been in LA and where he would make his new home in Sweden.
One night Johnny sang the truth to me on a northbound train from Nashville, Tennessee. Taught me all the letters in a loan. Sang, freedom is where you think it is, but there ain't no train to Stockholm.
There are many reasons Lee had to leave the U.S. He had burned bridges with the labels he'd promised hits for. His relationship with Susie Jane Hokum was crumbling. And he was hoping to avoid his son getting drafted for the Vietnam War.
of like when LHI disbanded, you know, he moved to Sweden. That was sort of it. You know, he kind of like got out of the, you know, got out of the mainstream, to say the least. Maybe, you know, we didn't have enough hit records. I remember this, and I want to be telling tales out of school, but I think Lee was somewhat disenchanted with the way things were going, especially, you know, in the music business. That would be the only thing I could think of, because, you know, it's one thing for someone to disband a company and then, you know, move to Colorado and, you know, and watch the trees grow. It's a whole other thing to disband a company, move to the other side of the world. So I'm not, you know, quite sure what all that motivation was, but it was probably a combination of a number of things.
He had the kind of a temper that would disregard you, the worst kind of temper possible. The worst kind of temper, the person that will not discuss anything, person that will not talk about it, selfish temper. You know, say something hurtful, behave in a hurtful manner, and walk away. And that's part of the self-fulfilling that I'm talking about, the prophecy of I'm going to get left, she's going to leave me. She's the best thing I ever had, but I screwed it up. That's all part of it. You can hear it. You can hear it in a lot of things. So you can kind of hear those years, you can hear how it goes. If you listen to the records, you can hear, and if you look at his career and you look at the things that he was producing, and you can start adding up just as well as I can, you can see the changes. It's like he's going to lose it. He has it for a moment, but it's going to go. And you hear that over and over again. I don't even have to listen to all of his music to tell you that. Because I lived with the guy. It was almost as though he set himself up.
You notice that the artist would like to get through with this son of a bitch and get on to something else.
And you wake up one morning and you say, I feel good. I don't miss her. I can live without her. And you soon learn that time will come, but it wasn't that day.
I am not going to have a good time, no matter what you do.
A bird can fly on just one wing, but then why should he? Where there's sky, there must be rain. Where there's you, there's me. So do it all, get it done. Be all there is to be. Then wrap yourself in something warm. Come on. Come on.
Okay, you just cut a record.
Thank you and good night.
Lee Hazlewood finished out the LHI era with the album Requiem for an Almost Lady, in which the track you just heard is from. I consider it one of the heaviest breakup records of all time, and one of Lee Hazlewood's most personal and best albums. Lee continued to make records throughout the 70s, in Sweden, Europe, and back to LA. There are a lot of interesting and good records, but that's a story for another day. I really appreciate you taking the time to listen to my Lee Hazlewood podcast, and for checking out Light in the Attic's Lee Hazlewood series. And most of all, thanks to Lee Hazlewood for all the music.
4 years down and 21 to go. 10,000 more breakfasts to go. 14 million seconds of living this away. I guess it's time I started to pray them bars away.
Thanks so much for listening to the Light in the Attic podcast. We hope we've infected you with a mean case of Hazlewoodism. You can find many releases from Lee Hazlewood Industries and from the man himself at lightintheattic.net. Talk to you next time.